Welcome, everybody, to the Right Now Mastermind class. This is Rochelle, the Right Now coach. Our guest today is Kelly James Enger, and she's talking about six-figure freelancing. Kelly James Enger escaped from the law in 1997, but don't worry, she's not a fugitive. Since then, the former attorney has maintained a successful freelance career, writing 700-plus articles for more than 50 national magazines. She's the author of 8 books under her own name, including Six Figure Freelancing, The Writer's Guide to Making More Money, and Ready, Aim, Specialize, Create Your Own Writing Specialty and Make More Money. She's also a ghostwriter, and her ghostwriting clients have included book publishers, packagers, nonprofits, and individuals. You can check out her blog, dollarsanddeadlines.blogspot.com, for advice about making more money as a nonfiction freelance writer. She lives outside Chicago with her husband, son, daughter, and a golden retriever. Welcome, Kelly.
Thanks, Rochelle. Happy to be back.
And I wanted to let you all know, first of all, if you're noisy, if you sense that things are noisy, you can mute yourself by pushing star 6. Everybody who attends today's call is going to be entered into a drawing to win a free coaching session with me, or win a coaching session. You don't have to pay for it. But I'm donating it. And you can also up your chances of winning by commenting on my review of Kelly's book on the blog. So, Kelly, let's just start by you telling us a little bit about how you started as a writer, what the beginning was like for you.
Well, you've already mentioned I escaped from the law, and I started freelancing full-time. I really didn't have much of a business plan. I started pitching. I'd come up with an idea. I'd pitch an idea to a particular market. If that didn't work, I'd try another market. I'd pitch another idea to the same market who rejected me. I mean, I didn't have a business plan per se, but through persistence and pretty much sheer will, I started getting assignments, and it took me about 18 months to get up to speed. I think the more important thing is for freelancers who are listening to the call, and one of my first suggestions would be, instead of using that hit or miss method, which is really what it was, is to pick a market that you want to write for, that you know you can write for more than once, and start coming up with ideas for that particular market. I kind of lucked into that without intending to, and that's when I really saw my business take off, where I wasn't trying to write for 30 or 40 different magazines. I was only trying to write for a handful. It's a much more efficient way of pitching yourself and marketing yourself, and you're much more likely to get repeat assignments from editors who you've worked with, as opposed to always, writing your first article for a new client. So anyway, with that being said, about 4 or 5 years in, I started writing books, and then about 3 or 4 years after that, I started collaborating on books, and that led to ghostwriting. And today, I still do books under my own name, I still do articles, but probably 80 to 90% of my work is either ghostwriting or co-authoring books and book proposals for subject matter experts.
Wow. And can you talk a little bit about that ghostwriting piece? You were here about a year ago talking about that, but I'm curious about what made you decide to go into ghostwriting.
Years ago, I was at ASJA, and Sarah Wernick, who's passed away a couple of years ago, but at the time was a very well-known co-author, was talking about how she worked, and what she would do is she would find an expert with a platform, i.e. the ability to sell a book. This is before Twitter and Facebook and everything, but someone who has a lot of media connections or, connections that they could use to promote the book, approach that person, have them pay her to write a book proposal. The book proposal would sell, and then she would spend the next year of her life writing that book for the client. And then the book would come out with, Strong Women Stay Young by Miriam Nelson and Sarah Wernick, and then the author would go and promote the book, and then Sarah would go on to the next book. And this is probably about 9 or 10 years ago that I heard her on this panel, and two things stuck out in my head. Number one, that she was making a really good living, and number two, I don't want to write somebody else's book. And but I had heard the message, and then by the time my first child came along and I was, had become a book author, I was spending more and more time promoting my books, yet not seeing any more income, because anyone will tell you it's not writing the book that's time-consuming. It's actually promoting the book after it's published. And I realized I needed to kind of change how I approached my business or I was going to go broke. And I kind of came to ghostwriting through the back door because I co-authored a book with a nutrition expert named Ellie Krieger that sold very well and still sells well today, and having my name on that book led to a lot of other ghosting projects. And really, ghosting is the same as co-authoring. You just don't have your name on the cover. So for me, for how I want to spend my work time, and having two kids, and having, you know, my children are my first priority. I work 15 hours a week now, make a full-time living, but that's because I'm doing so much ghostwriting, and I don't have to promote the books when they come out. So that's how I got into it and how I'm making it work for me now.
Oh, that's great. And what do you know, just to follow up on this, sure, what attributes does a writer need to kind of follow your footsteps and become,
sure,
a successful ghostwriter?
I really think the first part is, excuse me, I'm getting over cold here. You really have to be willing to do it. And like I said, 9 or 10 years ago, I wasn't willing. I only wanted to write my own books. It was about me and my ego, and that's fine. So you have to be able to set your ego aside, because you're not writing your book anymore. You're writing somebody else's book. Or maybe it's both of your book, but it is no longer your singular book.
Mm.
You know? I think that's really important. Obviously, you have to have writing skills. But I think the other three factors, you have to have good project management skills, because when you write your own book, you're in charge of what you're doing, and you know, okay, now I need to work on chapter two, or I need to interview people for this next chapter, or whatever it is. When you're working with a client, whether you're ghosting or co-authoring, I don't care which, you have to, are presumably getting at least some of your information, maybe almost all of your information from that client, whether that's through interviewing the person, or they're sending you work, or they're sending you research, or whatever it is, you're no, and in most books, I'm doing a fair amount of research on my own. That's why clients hire me, because they know if, let's say we're doing a chapter on exercise adherence, which means sticking with an exercise program, I can write about that because I have written about it and I know where to go. But you've got to be able to manage the project, meaning you have to tell your client, hey, I still need these anecdotes for this chapter, or I sent you the first three chapters and you haven't gotten it back to me and we need to stay on our deadline. So all kinds of little things like that. And again, this isn't an underling you're working with. This is your client. So you've got to be, have some skills keeping someone on track in a respectful way. The second part of that is being willing to act as kind of a, in addition to collaborating, I don't just write the book that the client hires me to write. I definitely try to come up with other, you know, well, have you thought about this, or let's include this, or really more of a brainstorming, collaborative spirit to the whole process. I don't just follow an outline. I mean, I say I'm not just going to write this for you. I'm going to put my thinking cap on and help you, you know, make your book an even better book.
Wow.
And then finally is the therapist part of it, where you're kind of holding someone's hand and saying, don't worry, I know this is your first book, but you can do it, and this book is going to be great, and it's going to reflect your voice, blah, blah, blah. And it really is important, because typically my clients are new book authors, otherwise they wouldn't need a ghostwriter or co-author, and they're very concerned that their book's going to be taken away from them, or their message isn't going to get across, or I'm going to somehow, you know, run over them. And you know, you have to be willing to really act like kind of a therapist, honestly. And I like doing that. That's what I like doing as a lawyer. So that's kind of a good fit for my personality.
You like being a therapist?
I do.
Or
if I had time and money, I would go back to school. Well, I like being a therapist when my clients do it, I tell them to. That's a little different.
That's great. Well, I want to go back to your book, Six Figure Freelancing. And before I do that, I want to remind people that Kelly also has a book on ghosting. Remind us what the title is.
Oh, thanks. It's Goodbye Byline, Hello Big Bucks, The Writer's Guide to Making Money, Ghostwriting, and Co-authoring Books. And if you notice, the concept of making money is in all three of my titles that are for freelancers, because that is my, it's my focus. It's my number one priority. I'm not saying that the work itself isn't important. It is, but I've been doing this for 14 years to help support my family. So it is definitely, I'm always coming at it from the professional mindset, or the business mindset, I should say.
Well, and that's a perfect segue to my next question, because I think this is the thing that really sets you apart as a freelance writer. And in the book, Six Figure Freelancing, you talk about the importance of freelance writers having a business and a money mindset.
Correct.
Rather than just the, oh, I'm in it for the craft and I'm a writer and blah, blah, blah. So can you tell us why that's essential and what you did to develop the mindset of a businesswoman?
Sure. Well, first of all, I always get some pushback when I speak at writers' conferences, because writers' conferences, other than ASJ, which is a different spin, but writers' conferences tend to attract people who want to write or want to be writers. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's great. That's how I started out, too. But when I decided I wanted to do it full time, I realized that I needed to make money doing this, and I needed to run it like a business. It couldn't be a hobby that I was doing on the side to fulfill my own desires to write. So that's a big distinction. You can write for yourself, which is great, but if you're going to write and get paid, then you're going to be writing for other people, whether you call them clients or call them editors or, you know, whoever they are. But that's a big jump to go from writing for yourself to writing for other clients / for pay. So I think it's really important, number one. How I did that when I started out is, even as a new freelancer, a new full-time freelancer, I never wrote for free. I did a lot of work for my local paper, and those stories paid, you know, $25, $35, $50 a story. Not very much money, but they paid something. And doing those stories sometimes led to other ideas for magazine articles. It got my name out in my community, which led to work. I mean, there were other reasons to do it. And quite frankly, it just helped me learn how to write articles, because I didn't come to this with a journalism degree, and I hadn't written a lead before, and I didn't know what a nut graph was, and I was kind of learning as I freelanced. So I think that's the first part of it. But the second part of it is, I always think of myself as a business person first, writer second. And I think it's okay to put them equally important, like you're a writer and a business person, that's fine. But the business had better be part of your concept of yourself as a freelancer, or I don't think you're going to be successful. And again, I'm not talking about somebody who wants to write fiction on the side or who has a blog that they love doing and they're going to keep up. I'm talking about you're doing this with an intent to make money, whether you're the sole support for yourself, whether you're the sole support for your family, whether you help support a family, I don't care, but it is a business. And publishing is a business. Editors don't care what you want to write. They care what their readers want to read. And I'm talking about magazine editors, web editors, book editors, whoever it is, it's a business. And I think that freelancers, to be successful, have to treat their writing like a business as well.
That makes a lot of sense. So in your book, you talk about kind of the difference between focusing on dollars per word versus dollars per hour. So I'm curious about the distinction between that and why that might be important if we're starting to think of ourselves as running a business.
Right. Well, and the concept was brought home to me a couple years ago. Well, actually, it was probably 5 or 6 years ago. You know, time flies. I was talking to a very successful writer at ASJA, the American Society of Journalists and Authors, and she asked me who I wrote for, and I said some of the magazines, and then she was like, oh, well, I write for blah, 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 and she rattled off a list, and you know, I was like, good for you. And then she commented on one of the magazines I wrote for and said, well, they don't pay a dollar a word. I said, no. She said, well, I can't believe you write for them. And I said, well, I don't care they don't pay a dollar a word. I know what I make per hour. Now, here's my point. So when I do work, I'm not going to name the magazine, but I'm a contributing editor at a magazine that I get $450 for a 1,500 word story. Obviously, that's not a dollar a word. It's not even 33 cents a word. It's about 30 cents a word. So at first glance, you might say, well, why would you bother doing that? Well, number one, the stories are often just written by me. They come right out of my head because I'm writing about a subject I know a lot about. So I can sit down and write a piece on, say, selling reprints or developing a platform as a writer or what to do when your story gets killed or whatever the topic is, and I know it. I'm the expert. It's like if I were to write about being a mom of two children ages, you know, 6 and 17 months, I'm the expert because I've done this. So the stories don't take me that long to write. Number two, I've worked with this magazine for years, and I almost never have edits, and I mean any edits. They love my stuff. It runs as is. There's no hassles. There's no, you know, I turn in the story. It looks great. Great. I get paid. And number three, because I'm writing about a particular subject that I have a niche in and a platform in, those columns help drive the sales of some of my books. So there's another benefit to it. But when I look at this story, pays $450 and it takes me 3 or 4 hours to write, which is about what it does, if you do the math, you can see I'm making more than $100 an hour, which is what I try to average when I work. And you might say, well, that's, you know, you can't always make that. No, you can't. But if, for example, I sell a couple of reprints and that takes me 15 minutes and that netted me $125 an hour, well, good, I'm kind of halfway toward what I call my daily nut. And my daily nut is, this year my goal is to make $60,000. I'm no longer trying to make six figures, at least not right now. I have two little kids. I work 15 hours a week. $60,000 is a good number for me to make. It helps me support our family, move to a new house, whatever. But what that breaks down to is $250 a day. So I have to average $250 every day, 5 days a week, 50 weeks out of the year. I give myself 2 weeks off for vacation to make that number. And the way I do that isn't necessarily taking an assignment that pays per word. It's how much is that assignment going to pay per hour? Because anyone who's written for national magazines will tell you, you can get an assignment that pays a dollar or two per word, but by the time you pitch it and then repitch it and then write an outline for it and then come up with 18 different sources for it and write it and then rewrite it, and then, you know, you might not be looking at anywhere close to a reasonable hourly rate. And I think that's really important. Maybe not starting out, but definitely something to think about as you get into the business.
That makes sense. And so you talk about something in the book called the 24-hour rule, which I thought was a real insightful way to kind of keep your momentum going and continue to earn money. So what is that? And
yeah,
how
and you
that
know
help?
What? The 24-hour rule is just one of these things I came up with as a new. I mean, I created this. I just decided that when I got a rejection, I actually call them bongs. But when I got a rejection from a magazine, two things would happen within 24 hours. Number one, I would do what I call a resub, and I would resubmit that query to another market. If Parents doesn't want it, I'll send it to Parenting. If Men's Health doesn't want it, I'll try Men's Journal. The idea is that you get it out again. It's not going to do you any good on your hard drive. Now, and with most ideas, you're going to have more than one potential market for them. Number two is I would send a new query to the editor who had rejected me within 24 hours and say, you know, dear Ms. Behan, thank you so much for your response. Notice I didn't say rejection. For your response to my query about women and weightlifting. While I'm sorry you can't use the idea, I have another for you to consider, colon, then I'd put the new query in. And what that does is it helps you create a relationship with somebody before you even have an assignment. That persistence and being willing to come back after a rejection is what led to me getting assignments with markets like Fitness and Shape and Woman's Day and Family Circle and Health. With none of those markets did my first query sell. I mean, it wasn't like I just came out writing these stellar queries, but when they said no thanks, I'd say, oh, okay, here's another one. And I blogged about this recently, and I say, when you go into the Gap and for some reason, you know, you try on pleated pants, which I'm sorry, don't look good on anyone, and they don't look good, the Gap sales girl doesn't say, okay, bye. You know, she says, hey, how about the flat fronts, or how about the boycott, or try our new capris, or these are, she's going to keep bringing you pants until you buy some pants. And that's what I tell writers to be the Gap sales girl. Okay, you don't like that idea? Here's another idea. And one of two things will happen. Either you'll get an assignment eventually, or you'll never get anywhere, you know, just a standard rejection, or you never hear it, you know, whatever. And then maybe it's time to cut bait and move on. I do, you know, I pitched Glamour for years, could never get past the standard rejection. At a certain point, I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to try them anymore. But it's just a way of creating a relationship with an editor. And usually what you'll see happen is you get the, you know, formal or the form rejection, and then maybe you get with an email, like a personal note, hey, we like this, but we've got something similar, or please pitch me your ideas, or that your writing is great, but this idea isn't right for us. But the bottom line is that the 24-hour rule turns a rejection into two opportunities. And also, just as important, it takes away the question of what do I do next? Oh, no, I got rejected. I'm like, okay, you got rejected. Send it out to a new market. Come up with a new idea. So I think it's really, it's for all the writers who are like, well, what do I do, you know, if I get rejected? It's like, well, then you apply the 24-hour rule. Or maybe it's the 48-hour rule or 72-hour. The idea is to give yourself a pretty tight timeline. So number one, you get it done. Number two, you stay on that editor's radar. And she's like, wow, she came back to me with a great idea. Telling you 95% of freelancers don't do that. They pitch an idea, they get rejected, and then they skulk away, never to be heard from again.
Yeah, and I think it's more of that business mindset again. It's not
exactly
about
right.
You rejected me. It's just,
right.
This idea doesn't work.
It was not the right idea at the right time to the right editor at the right publication. It has nothing to do with you.
Yep. Well, now we've talked a little bit about this idea of writers specializing, and you have a book called Ready, Aim, Specialize. So I want you to just flesh that out a little bit for us. So, you know, first of all, why specialize? Wouldn't it be better just to be the all things to all people writer? And then if we're going to specialize, how do we know what to choose? You know, what if we choose, you know, the life of a mite and nobody
right.
wants our article?
Exactly. Yeah, I don't think there's a lot of demand for the life of the mite article. well, I think, first of all, I don't think the vast majority of successful freelancers really cannot be a jack-of-all-trades writer. I mean, if you think about it in your own life, you really can't do everything well. In your own personal life, you're going to pick a few things like, you know, I care about being a really good parent. I don't care about being a really good parallel parker, which is good because I'm a terrible parallel parker. Mm-hmm. Could I become a better one? Yeah, but it's not worth my time and effort. So I think when you specialize, you say, okay, these are the things I'm going to focus on. And occasionally I'll break out of my specialty and cover something else. But the bottom line is that the vast majority of my work falls into health, fitness, nutrition, wellness. Number one, I know a lot about those subjects because I've been writing about them for years. And a lot of the subjects have personal interest to me. For example, fitness and nutrition have been topics of interest to me since I was in college. So we're looking at, you know, decades of interest in and reading about and developing knowledge in those areas. Secondly, it lets me keep up on what's going on in these fields without getting overwhelmed, because honestly, like when I write about health, I just mostly write women's health, occasionally children's health, but really I just focus on women's health. I'm not covering pediatric health. I'm not covering men's health. I'm not covering senior health. I'm not covering alternative health so much. So it lets me stay up on what's going on without being overloaded with information, which I think is really difficult to avoid these days. And it lets me pitch ideas. So when I just saw a study that showed up today on one of my news feeds that talked about the size of your fork affecting how much you eat at a meal. Now, that would be a great lead for me to pitch a diet story or a nutrition story or how food cues and food environment affects how much you eat, because, boom, I happen to notice it. Somebody who doesn't write about nutrition or diet, that wouldn't have even been on their radar. You know what I mean? It just makes you more focused and more aware of what's going on. And the other part of it, too, is I have hundreds of sources I've interviewed over the years in these areas. I have people who I can call and say, hey, Jen, do you have a 5 minutes? I just need a quick and dirty interview for this query I'm writing, or if I need to turn something around quickly, I've already got a database I can rely on, so it makes it much more quicker for me to research the piece and then write the piece, because chances are, even if I don't know something about this, say, new, you know, acai bean or acai bean or whatever they call it, I do know what antioxidants are, I do know what flavonoids are, I do know what phytochemicals are, so I have a framework to write about it. When it comes to what you specialize in, I actually suggest that people start, number one, with what they already know about and have experience in. Number two, they look at what the competition is. So you want to write about travel? Well, that's great, but let me tell you, you're going to be competing against established travel writers, writers like me who do travel once in a while because we try to write off part of our vacations. You know, so there's a lot of competition in that field. And then third, how many markets are there for it? So one of the reasons I specialize in health, fitness, nutrition, and wellness is because there's tons of markets for it. A lot of magazines cover those subjects. There's a lot of books published on those subjects. Those subjects are of interest to a lot of people. So, yeah, like you said, the life of the mite, no, I don't think that's really a good specialty. I don't think writing about insects is a good specialty. unless you are maybe coming to it from a, you're going to cover insects for children's magazines and you're going to cover infestations for homeowners' magazines. But even so, that just seems like a harder row to hoe, if you will. The better specialties are things, business, health. Those two things affect everyone. And then if you want to break it down a little, maybe you're going to focus on, I know a writer who started out writing for a trade magazine that focuses on appliances. Now she's developing a niche in home electronics. Well, let me tell you, that's actually a really clever specialty because she's still got the trade side, the appliance side, but she's also taking it. And think of how many people have home electronics. We all do. Does anyone know how to work them? No. So if she could be writing about anything from the iPad to a new digital stove or whatever it is, but that to me is a smart specialty because she's using her knowledge, she knows what the markets are, and it's something that she can continue to kind of, the technology is going to change and that makes her valuable as she keeps up with it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. So one of the things I noticed in your book, and I know you're known for, is selling multiple stories or selling reprints. And, you know, so you talked about that one idea, one story mindset and why that doesn't really work. Can you kind of flesh this out for us and explain what you mean?
Yeah, what I don't want writers to do is what I did early on, which is I would come up with an idea, find a market, and write a story about it. And then I would go on to the next idea, the next angle, the next market, and it's not very efficient. So I recently blogged about this too. I wrote about the Lions Car Show, which is a charity car show in the town I used to live in. I wrote one story about the car show for the Lion magazine and moved on. I never wrote about car shows again. I never wrote about cars again. And I never wrote for The Lion again. It didn't occur to me that after the editor accepted the piece and ran it word for word as is, he obviously liked it, I never pitched him again. I just wasn't thinking. And I had all this knowledge on how you hold a charity car show, and I never wrote about that again. I just really wasn't thinking. I hadn't figured it out. So, for example, I did a piece on the health benefits of gratitude for a custom magazine. That was actually a piece they assigned to me. It wasn't something I was up on. So I had all this research on gratitude. It's really interesting. It turns out that being grateful actually makes you physically more healthy, which is sort of surprising. So I did another piece for a women's magazine on surprising ways to be healthy and included, surprise, surprise, you know, being grateful. Then I wrote another piece for the Chicago Tribune, and the focus was on helping your kids learn how to be grateful. And the idea was from a parenting angle, but also this is a way not only to teach your kids manners, but it helps create emotional resilience in them and helps them fight off colds. Or, you know, so the idea is that you're always taking an idea and coming up with different angles and different spins for different markets. I try to never write about a story one time. I'm always trying to write about it over and over until, honestly, I'm sick of it. So that's the idea of what I call reslanting, where you take an idea, you come up with more than one angle, more than one audience, more than one market, and you keep shopping it around and writing about it in different ways.
So, and then what's the difference between that and pursuing reprint prints?
Thanks, Beth.
Do you do that?
Because people seem to get those things confused. A reslant is a totally new story, even if it's on the same subject. And I already gave some examples of that.
Yeah.
A reprint is when a story has been published in a market, whether it's print or online or whatever, and then you sell the rights to reprint that piece to another market. So let me think of an example here. So let's go back to the story I did on the surprising ways to be happy. So that originally ran in a women's magazine, and I retained reprint rights. So then I turned around and sold it to a small regional kind of a health and fitness magazine. Now, they don't pay nearly as much, but it's the same story. So I'm getting paid a second time for the article. And there's actually a third kind of reprint that I like to call a tweak. And a tweak is where, again, I'll give another example. I did a piece for Women's Day years ago called, like, Drop 15 Pounds in 2 Months. I can't remember what the working title was, but it was a diet story. Excuse me. And then I resold it. I sold reprint rights to it to a bridal magazine. And what I changed was instead of the woman reading it was trying to get, you know, ready to slip into her shorts or her swimsuit, it was for a bride getting ready to slip into her wedding dress. And I took out a couple parts of the story that were about exercising with your kids or taking your kids to soccer games, which most brides are not going to be worried about, and just made a few small tweaks in the story so that it was aimed at a bride. Took me maybe 10, 15 minutes to do that, and that story resold for $250 because I took the time to tweak it for the market. It's still a reprint. It still appeared before, but I made a few small changes for it to better fit the market. So a reslant is when you write about the same topic more than once in different ways. A reprint is the story has appeared in print before or online, I don't care, and you're reselling it. And then a tweak is a reprint that you've kind of tweaked to better, to increase the chances of it selling to a reprint market.
And, you know, this conversation about reprints and reslants brings up an important topic that you cover in quite a lot of detail in your book. But I wonder if you could talk about copyright a bit with our readers, because I think as a beginning writer, I did a lot of work for hire. I did a lot of things that I sold all rights to that I have no right to go back and reuse again.
Right.
And it just kills me now that I look at that at those years of wasted. I mean, not wasted, but I didn't make as much per word or per hour. So why don't you talk a little bit about the importance of copyright and protecting copyright.
When we talk about copyright, we're talking, first of all, I don't want to get into the whole copyright statute, but the bottom line is the copyright statute says that when you create something in fixed form, meaning you get it down on the page or on your screen, it's the copyright to that work is automatically created concurrently with you creating the work. So meaning you have all of the rights to that piece of work until or unless you sell or transfer or license them to someone else. So if you sign, as you mentioned, a work for hire or an all rights contract, what you do is you hand over all the rights. The statute talks about a bundle of rights, and you go, here you go. Then that publisher can do anything they want with that story. They can put it on a T-shirt. They can turn it into a movie. They can create a novel out of it. Whatever they can do because you sold all rights. When you retain rights, so let's say you sell first North American serial rights, meaning the right to publish it for the first time in a magazine in North America, and maybe you sell some web rights, meaning that, you know, the right to put it on the World Wide Web, if you don't sell everything, you retain some rights. And I do like to retain some rights to my work, even when I have all rights contracts shoved down my throat, which I sometimes do. I will say, you know what, I hate all rights contracts. Is there any way you can just let me retain non-exclusive reprint rights? And what that does is it lets your publisher still have everything, which the publisher wants, but it lets me offer non-exclusive reprint rights to these smaller markets I have that, you know, just need some copy to fill their pages. And again, this isn't going to make a lot of money, but at least I have some rights to my work. It's not exclusive, it's not exclusive, but that way I'm retaining something. That being said, I still will sign an all rights contract if I have to. And some of the things I look at, number one, how busy am I? You know what I mean? It's a question of economics. If I'm really busy and I don't need the work, I'm more likely to say no. If I'm slow and I need the money, then I'm more likely to say yes. It's just how it goes. But I also look at factors like how much are they paying? How much time is it going to take me? Is this something I can reprint? And then, you know, again, I did some work for a custom publisher where it was all rights. Non-negotiable, all rights. But the publisher was great. She paid me promptly. My editor paid me promptly. The stories were fun to do. They were easy to write and research. My hourly rate was really high. Did I try to get retained rights? Yeah, but they wouldn't do it. So it's like, well, you know what, though? I still want to do these stories. It's still money. It's still work. So I think it's good to think about when you're starting out. But honestly, Rochelle, I think new writers should focus on getting some clips and connections going before they start worrying about rights. Because I always, at the writer's conference, I always have at least one person go, well, what about rights? What about rights? I'm like, well, why don't you get some assignments first? You know what I mean? It's like, get to the point where you feel like, okay, I'm going to negotiate. I didn't negotiate a contract, you know, if you've read Six Figure, for more than a year because I was afraid I'd lose the work. And I think when you have established yourself and you have some clips and you have some confidence, you're more likely to go in. Like if I say, you know, I hate signing all rights contracts, it hamstrings me from selling reprints, and that's sort of my 401k. I'm in a better position to get what I want than someone just starting out who's unproven, who's already, you know, complaining about the contract, and you don't have any clips. You know what I mean? I just think you're in a better position to negotiate.
That makes a ton of sense. Well, one of the things that I'm hearing as you talk is the importance of developing long-term relationships with editors, other clients who hire you to write, and other writers. So talk about the importance of developing a network of people as a professional writer.
Well, and you know, the funny thing is, the last few years as I've gone to writers' conference, it's all about social media. You got to get on Twitter. You got to get on Facebook. You got to get on LinkedIn. Well, all that is creating connections with people, but that's not really the answer. You know, you don't just go on Facebook and then the work rolls in. But I think it's really important it's easier to work for a small handful of clients than to work for 30, 40, 50 people, obviously. But when your clients and editors know you and you do good work for them, they pass your name along, and that's really important. And then you get to spend less time marketing because your clients are marketing for you. And that, you know, more than half of my work these days comes from referrals. When I was doing a lot more magazine stuff, a fair amount of my work came from referrals. An editor would email me and say, hey, I got your name from so-and-so. Would you be interested in writing for me? I know that's every freelancer's fantasy, but that does happen a lot because you'd much rather work for someone who's been a proven entity, you know, who's done some work for a friend of yours than just, you know, start from scratch, which makes sense. So, yes, developing relationships with the editors and clients, which is, you know, basic things like turning stuff in on time or beforehand. If they want edits, I don't pitch a fit. I might be annoyed, but I don't let the editor know. I'm very responsive. You know, if an editor or a potential editor or potential client emails or calls, I mean, I get back to them ASAP. I'm not always that responsive with my personal email. You know, I mean, it will take days for me to get back to, quote, normal people. And then part of it is really trying to make their life easier. If I have a suggestion for art, I'm doing a sidebar and it's running long. This actually happened. I had a piece that was running about 200 words over, and I emailed my editor and said, look, I'm doing this quiz, and it's a great quiz, but I'm coming in at 200 words over. Do you want me to cut it? She goes, no, that's fine. I'll allot extra space. I definitely want it. So it's just like being her colleague, you know, not thinking at kind of treating her like you're on equal ground. They like that. in terms of relationships with other people, for example, sources. When I interview someone, I send them a personal thank you note. I let them know when they're quoted. That, to me, is basic good manners, but you would be amazed at how many sources remember me. What I'm doing now is I let my sources know, hey, by the way, I'm a ghostwriter and co-author. If you know anybody who wants to do a book, please keep me in mind. Another thing with other writers, if a project comes to me, this just happened. I had somebody contact me about a memoir, and she's got money, and she knows she's going to spend money on this book. It's just not the right book for me, so I gave her the names of two ghostwriters I know who do memoirs, and she hired one of them. So you really have to, you know, look for opportunities like that, because that's what building relationships is about. It's not just, okay, how is this going to help me? It's part of it's being genuine, too. I mean, you can't just be like, I think I'm pretty good. If I can help someone, I will. I won't spoon-feed them, but certainly if I can say, you know, I get a lot of email, people say, oh, I read Six Figure Freelancing, but I have a question you didn't address. I always personally respond to those emails. I do not personally respond to emails that are like, oh, I know you're a freelancer. I want to be a freelancer. What do I do? You know, I respond, but they get a canned response, and I never hear from them again. But my point is, I know that when I take the time to send a personal email, that person will remember me. And I have been at conferences. People have come up to me and said, I emailed you 8 years ago, and you emailed me back, and you were so helpful, and that's how I started feeling. I'm like, wow. But I really think all those little things do add up. And that those relationships and your network is really, really important. I think we think of writing first. If I were starting my career over, I would think relationships first, writing second. I really would. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would totally turn it on its head.
Yeah, and to add to that, just the thing that one of my pet peeves as a writer and an editor and coach is watching people complain about their editors or their clients on Facebook or Twitter.
Oh, my God. I never put anything negative like that online, ever. You don't know who's going to look at it. Yeah,
exactly.
I agree. You
should, exactly.
In my opinion, you shouldn't put anything negative, period. Like, if I'm having a day where I'm feeling challenged by freelancing, the last thing I'm going to do is go post that somewhere. I project an image of success. And no, I don't feel like that every second. But people who don't know me personally think I do, and that's okay. You know, people want to work with busy, successful people. They don't want to work with negative, doubting, hand-wringing types. You know, I mean, we all know that intuitively that's true.
It's absolutely unprofessional. I would never want to see my editor complaining about my work online.
Right.
So why would they want to see me complaining about them?
And especially with something like Facebook, where I have former clients or current clients who are my Facebook friends. So if I were to say something that they might think I'm complaining about them. I agree. That looks really bad.
So one of the things in terms of keeping relationships is that first step, which is developing relationships. And you talk in your book about cold calling, which just makes me, the introvert, want to just hide under my desk. You know, it's just like, okay, I'm gonna like not look at this book again if she's going to tell me to cold call.
Right.
So tell me what that means and how you did it and how it worked for you.
Honestly, what I like to do is I like to start, I used to do it via snail mail. Now I would do it with email. So I send an email, and then in the email I say something like, I'll call within a couple weeks to follow up on this email. So that way, to me, it's not really a cold call so much. It's like you've already opened the door with your email. And even if they haven't had a chance to read it, you can always say, oh, I'm calling to follow up on my email. But I think that you sort of honestly, any query you send is a cold call. That's all it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're resistant to doing that, I think you start with an email, and then you just, you know, drink some coffee and say, okay, I'm going to follow up on all those emails. It's much easier to do them all together, too, because once you do a couple, kind of the anxiety wears off. You're like, well, crap, I'm just going to keep doing this now. So, but I think the more you put something off and the more you worry about it, the worse it gets. And believe me, I hate marketing myself as much as anybody else. But when I say, okay, I'm going to make these calls at 9 o'clock or 8 o'clock, I don't try to do everything that I hate to do first thing in the morning. When I'm done, I'm like, oh, good. Now the rest of my day, you know, can only get better. So does that help?
That helped a ton. And I like the idea of thinking about your query as your first call. So it's not really like you're doing a cold call. You've already made a connection.
Right, or your query or your letter of introduction or whatever. Exactly. And, I mean, to succeed in this business, you have to be able to market yourself. Otherwise, you're sort of going to not get any work unless you happen to have this fantastic network of people who are just going to beat down your door, which has not happened to me yet, and I've been doing it for 14 years. So.
Well, and that's a good thing to remember, is that if this is a business, If it's a job, then you do what it takes to get the client.
Exactly. Right. And not all of it is fun. You know, that's, I mean, it's like, that's why it's a job. That's why they pay you to do it. It's not supposed to be fun every single minute. Life isn't
it's
fun
work.
Every single minute. Yeah.
It's work. Well, we have about 10 minutes before you need to head off.
Okay.
So I have a few more questions, but I want to open up to our guests in case they have questions. So guests, to unmute yourself at *7, this is your chance to ask Kelly the questions that you have. And if you don't have any, I have more. Don't worry. But I'd love to hear from you.
This is Kathy Howison, and I do have a question. Early on in the interview, you had referenced getting paid to write, I think it was a book proposal, if you were going to maybe co-write or ghostwrite
right.
a book. How do you determine how much you're going to charge for that?
I try to get a sense for how much work it's going to be and how much work the client is going to do. Like, I have clients who will write part of it or give me research. I have other clients where I'm working with bare bones and doing a lot of it. But I'll just tell you, right now, my proposals are running about $4,000 or $5,000. 3 or 4 years ago, it was more like $7,000 to $10,000. So the economy has definitely affected that. But go ahead. Pardon?
That would be the fee for writing the book proposal to...
The proposal, correct. Because the proposal outlines the book, provides the marketing promotion section. It basically gets the book ready to go, and you're including a book chapter, at least one if you have a new author, maybe two. So my point is, I used to charge more for them, and I can't just because as the economy's gone downhill. But typically, you're talking about $4,000 to $5,000, or I'm talking about. I know other writers who charge more. I know writers who will do it for less, but I can't, for the amount of time, I can't do it for less than that.
Now, would
and
that include
go ahead, Kathy.
Multiple editors, assuming that the first one doesn't jump up and down and say, I've been waiting for this?
I didn't hear the first part of what you said, Kathy.
Would that include going to multiple book publishing editors, assuming the first one doesn't grab it?
That's not my job. I'm the writer. That's the client's job to actually market it, whether they have an agent or whether they pitch it themselves to editors. I'm just the ghost or co-author. I'm not an agent, and I'm not in charge of selling the book. And I make that clear to clients. But they need, if they're going to approach a traditional publisher, they need a book proposal to do that, however they decide that they're, you know, whether they're going to work with an agent or not.
Oh, okay.
But the proposal would be the same proposal. It's just going to be submitted to different people.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yep. Okay.
And Kelly, it seems to me that when you were on our call about a year ago, you talked about kind of basing your rate on $100 an hour and making the figures from there. So
that's right.
I mean,
that's
it seems
right.
to me you're thinking this is going to be a 40 to 50 hour job.
Exactly. And so, and again, if my client, if it's a complex subject that I'm going to have to get up to speed, I'm going to charge more. If my client has a lot of work already in the can, I'm going to charge less. But it is that I'm always basing. Now, I don't always make $100 an hour, but that's what I aim for. Yes. And again, I don't want people to think, oh, that's impossible, because I have been doing this for 14 years, and I'm typically writing about subjects I have a pretty deep background in. So I'm not trying to get up to speed on, like, you know, 101 ways to use your iPhone, which would take me months and months to get, you know, to be able to write.
Mm-hmm.
All I know what to do with my iPhone is make calls. So, and I'm not kidding.
And go to realtor.com. That's the other thing
you
can
exactly.
do.
That's right.
Other questions? Thanks, Kathy.
Thank you.
Hi, Kelly. This is Kimberly and May. I have a question for you about queries.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
What's the best way to track down who you should contact in Writer Guidelines? Because I've been having a lot of trouble finding that information.
You know what? Sometimes it'll be on the website. I mean, pretty much every publication has a website now that has the guidelines, which is much easier than 14, 15 years ago. But honestly, you can, if it's not there, you can send an email to the website or just get the phone number for the publication and call. People are afraid to call, but all you're going to do is call, and some, you know, receptionist is going to answer the phone or hit zero if you get the voicemail or the automated answering system, and the person you say, hi, I'm a freelancer. Can you tell me the name of the person who edits the blah, blah, blah section? And they'll give you the name, and if you know the email format, you can figure it out from there. But just say, can you give me their email, please? I mean, sometimes it just takes that little extra legwork to do that. So I would start with a website. I would send an email to the webmaster or to the site itself, or just call. I mean, calling is probably the fastest way. I do a lot of things by phone simply because it's quicker for me to pick up the phone than send an email and wait for a response. With phone, you usually get an immediate response.
Okay.
All right?
Thanks.
Thank you. Other questions? Jimmy, a question as we kind of wrap up our time with Kelly today.
Okay.
Well, Kelly, I have a
covered
question.
Everything, Rochelle.
You did. I have a question. One of the markets you talk a little bit in the book, and I know that for a lot of my colleagues has been incredibly lucrative, has been corporate writing.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just say a bit about that and how people get into corporate writing, what it is and how you get into it?
Sure. It can be a lot of different things. It can be doing copywriting. It can be brochures. It can be web copy, newsletters, pretty much anything that a business puts out. I mean, you just have to think broadly. I think the big thing is to start with companies or businesses that, again, you have some kind of background in. The work I've done has been either for ad agencies where I was doing copy for brochures. I've worked for companies like Pampered Chef, which, surprise, surprise, they write about food, not so much nutrition, but food and cooking, and I've written about that kind of stuff. But to start with some, you know, look for businesses or companies that you have a background in or at least kind of get. So, for example, if I was going to pursue bigger dental practices that need writers, my dad's a dentist, and before I went to law school, I worked as a receptionist in his office. Even though that was more than 20 years ago, I understand what dental offices look like. I understand some of the financing issues, some of the patient issues, so that kind of thing. I worked part-time at Trader Joe's years ago, so if I were approaching a retail grocer or any kind of company that does retail-type stuff, I get that. I know what POS means. I know what means point of sale. You know, I've got a background in that subject. So start with that. And then also, depending on the size of your community, small to medium-sized businesses that don't have writers on staff still need a lot of stuff written for them. So it might be worth it to join your local chamber or simply kind of spread the word and say, yeah, you know, I also do copywriting, or if you want to get a website up or you want to send an maybe an annual report out that you need some help with. It's just sort of looking for clients who might be willing to hire you and you think you can do the work. Again, I didn't know how to do copywriting when I did it, but Bob Bly has some great books on copywriting. Peter Bowerman is really the person for copy and business writing. His book, The Well-Fed Writer, and I believe he's on his third book now, but The Well-Fed Writer, Back for Seconds, and then he's got The Well-Fed Publisher, I think, now. But, I mean, just looking for potential clients, I definitely recommend Bowerman's books as a good place if you want to learn more about that.
That's great. I really appreciate you being here, Kelly. This has been wonderful.
Sure. Yeah, my pleasure.
I remind everybody to go to the blog, rightnowcoach.com, where you'll find a link to Kelly's books and Kelly's blog, Dollars and Deadlines, which is another helpful tool for you all. Kelly, do you have a final tip you'd like to leave with our listeners today?
Yeah, I really think what helps is for people who are listening and are excited and thinking, oh, you know what, I want to do this, or she gave me a good idea, give yourself a specific goal. You know, say, okay, I'll send a query out to whatever the market is by Friday or by Monday or whatever. But give yourself a specific goal, like when you hang up the phone, write it down and do it. Because just by setting a specific goal, not, okay, I'll do this tomorrow, but doing it immediately increases your chances of following through, and it helps you start create momentum. So that would be my tip. I don't care what goal you decide to set, but set a specific goal and follow it through.
That's great. Thanks so much, Kelly. Always good to connect with you, and happy house hunting.
Okay,
thanks. Take care, everyone.
Have a great day. All right.
Bye-bye. You too. Bye-bye. Thanks, everyone.